Good afternoon, everybody. We want to continue this discussion on Kalama Sutta. This morning we discussed its emotional side. Now we go to the second part, which is based on reasons. That is even more interesting and very real core of the sutta. First of them is not to believe anything on the basis of logic. Thakka hetu. As you all know, those who have studied logic, logic can be used for proving anything you want, depending on how skillful you are. What you conclude may not necessarily be the truth, but you follow the logical steps, whether it is traditional logic or symbolic logic, logic used in mathematics and so forth. You can prove something. But what you have proved may not necessarily be true, but you have proved is the logical, conclusion. And therefore, the Buddha's teaching is not that kind of logical teaching. And Buddha said it is realizable by the wise. And Buddha said it is enough to cause you bewilderment, Vaccha, when he was discussing things with Vaccha Gotta. He said it is enough to cause you bewilderment, Vaccha, enough to cause you confusion. For this Dhamma Vaccha is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. If we take some examples, when we say, if he says it is not logical and so forth, then we can get into confusion again, because many a time people say the Dhamma Buddha's teaching is real, logical, empirical. Dhamma is not empirical. So from empirical evidence you cannot prove Dhamma. It is physical, chemical, logical, philosophical things you can prove empirically. Dhamma is something much deeper than that. I give you a few examples. When you think of these examples, you can see the real meaning of this statement of the Buddha. In the Dhammapada, there is a statement, kumbhupamang khayamimang viditva, nagarupamang chittamidang tapetva, yodheta marang panya yudhena jitancha rakke anivesano siya. Kumbhupamam kaya mimam viditva, having understood this body as a clay pot, brittle, subject to break, nagarupamam cittamidam thapetva, understanding the mind like a city, yodheta marang panyayudhena, fight the mara with weapon of wisdom. Panyayudha, panyayudha means weapon, panya means wisdom, panyayudhena means weapon of wisdom, and protect what you gain without attachment. This is the last sentence, is the catchy sentence. Protect what you gain without attachment. It sounds like a dilemma, contradictory, because when the very attempt to protect something proves that you are attached to it, otherwise why do you want to protect it? Isn't it? The very reason for you try to protect something is that you are attached to it. If you are not attached to it, you will never try to protect it. But Buddha said, fight the Mara with weapon of wisdom. When you fight the Mara, you gain something. You gain certain area, certain space, certain property, certain something. In order to gain that, you fight. When you fight and got the particular thing, then you dearly attach to it, you station your army, your boundary lines, and you write your laws, constitution, lawyers, and so forth and so on. You do everything possible to protect what you have gained. Why? Because you are attached to it. Buddha said, protect what you gain without attachment. How can you do that? Because if you are attached to something, you have not gained. You have lost. Your fight is the fight against attachment. Your mara is attachment. Clinging, craving is your mara. You fight against this mara, and when you fight against the mara of attachment, then you learn to let go. Letting go is a big battle. And once you have gained this letting go of state, then even if you have any more attachment, then you have lost the battle. You have not gained it. Now, how can you prove that? You can prove only when you look at your own mind. You can look at your own mind, and you struggle very hard to get rid of your desire, greed, and clinging, and craving. Once you have gotten rid of your craving, clinging, then if there is a scruple of clinging, you still have not won the battle. You still have to fight. And therefore, it is not something logically that you can prove, but experientially you can prove it. You can prove to yourself. You are the witness, you are the testimony, you are the one who experienced it. Only through experience you can see this reality. Another example, when we describe Nibbana, Nibbana is called avedita sukha. One day, you can find it in Samyutta Nikaya, monks asked Venerable Sariputta, why do we attain Nibbana? He said to have happiness. Then they asked, is it a feeling? Happiness is a feeling, Nibbanic happiness is a feeling. He said, Nibbanic happiness is not a feeling. Then they asked, if it is not a feeling, how can you say it is happiness? Logically, something to be called happiness, you should feel it. If you do not feel it, how can you say that it is happiness? If you say that it is a feeling, there has to be an entity to feel. When there is no an entity to feel, then happiness cannot be a feeling. So Venerable Sariputta, when these monks asked, if it is not a feeling, how can you say that it is happiness? Venerable Sariputta's answer was, that is why it is called sukha. Since there is no feeling, it is called sukha. When there is a feeling, it can be pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and happiness now may change into unhappiness another time, and so forth. So when you look at it logically, it doesn't sound correct. But when you see it from a very dhammic, experiential perspective, you can see it is happiness in the sense that there is no being to feel that happiness. And therefore it is called avedita sukha, in experiential happiness. Another example. This is we call Buddha said sabbe sankhara anicchati yada panyaya passati atha nibbindati dukke esamaggo visuddhya. When one sees that all conditioned things are impermanent, unsatisfactory, I recited only one line, one stanza, but other two also almost a repetition, except the last one is sabbe dhamma anatta, and so forth, sabbe sankhara anicca, dukkha, sabbe dhamma anatta, that means all conditioned things are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and all dhammas are without self. When one sees this exactly as they are, then one will become disappointed with suffering. Atha nibbindati dukke esamagu. Nibbinda means one becomes dispassionate with suffering. When you hear the word very mindfully, you hear one becomes dispassionate with suffering. When you hear you become dispassionate with suffering, it implies that you have been passionate with suffering for you to become dispassionate later on, isn't it? Then you can ask, has there ever been in your life any time in your life that you were passionate or attached to suffering? You never have become attached to suffering. Now here it says, when you see this reality, you become disenchanted, dispassionate with suffering. Disenchantment or nibbida. Nibbida is another very beautiful Pali term. When it is translated into English, we have to use either dispassionate or disenchanted, but none of these words conveys the real deep meaning of nibbida. Because both words are sort of negative. Nibbida in Pali means yada panyaya pasati. Yada panyaya pasati. When you see with wisdom, you will be disenchanted, meaning you will not become excited. You will not get carried away with emotions. You become very insightful. Buddha has given a very beautiful simile. You can find out many similes on your own. Buddha's simile is children making sand castles on the beach. They go to beach and they get sand and build sand castles. In here, in winter, you can see children building various type of images with snow. Snow houses, snow man, snow this, snow that. And they look like real houses, real people. And they put even color, you know, to make their eyes black color or brown, what you call, blown on the hair, and so forth, to make them look real human beings. When they go to the beach, they make sand castles. And they really, in their mind, they seem really enjoy this. Going into the sand castles, coming out of it, cooking their meals and so forth, little children. But when they grow up, or after some time, they get tired of these sand castles. They don't hate it. They don't hate. When they get tired of it, they simply, you know, kick and dismantle and break them and, you know, throw the sands here and there. Similarly, when one spiritually mature and see the reality, then one would become not interested in those things anymore. The person have a deep insight. Yeah, after all, say, I give another example. These examples may sound very abstract, but you know, to drive my point home, even though the examples sound abstract, I like to mention them. We say that you say you are 50 years old. You celebrate your 50th birthday. What you are really celebrating is that you have lost 50 years. You have not gained. On the 50th year, you have not gained one single minute. You have lost. 51st year, you celebrate losing one more year. I have lost 80 years. When I look back, is there anything that I have to keep from this 80 years? All I have is a memory. That's all. And therefore, when I think of it, there is nothing to become attached to. I am losing. So after some time, doctors might say, Mister, you will have 1 week to live. So I went on losing, and they say, you have 1 more week to lose. They don't say that you have 1 week to lose. They say, you have 1 week to live. But really, in reality, I will lose 1 more week. And then that is the end. When we really mindfully look at the things as they happening, as they are, impermanence, this is the kind of realization we come to. Logically, you can never prove it. But experientially, each and every one of you think of how long you have lived, that long you have lost. And this is called this kind of understanding, this kind of not exciting of the past comes to you through experience. This is called Nibbida, disenchanted. You are not disappointed, you are not upset, you are not angry, you have lived your life, but when we pause and look back, in reality there is no one single iota to trace one single minute back, except the memory. So, atha nibbindati dukkhe means then one becomes disenchanted with suffering, meaning it doesn't mean that we have enjoyed suffering before for us to be disenchanted with suffering now. We never enjoyed it. What it means is, I mentioned in many times in my Dhamma talks, Buddha said, Yo sukhang abhinandati, so dukhang abhinandati. One who enjoys pleasure enjoys pain. How? I call it, you buy one, get one free. What you get free is dukkha, but you work very hard to gain pleasure, happiness. When we work very hard to gain pleasure, along with this pleasure, displeasure sneaks in. You cannot say goodbye to displeasure and say, you don't come. I only need pleasure. I don't need pain. You may say so and wish so. That is the wishful thinking, but it is never going to happen. Disenchantment means we understand this true nature and put both of them on the same pedestal. We put both of them on the same level. Why? This moment pleasure becomes displeasure next moment. This moment displeasure can be a pleasure next moment. And these two always interchangeable. They take turn, that's all. They take turn. They have sort of an agreement. Pleasure and pain has unwritten agreement that today I take my turn, tomorrow you take your turn. That kind of agreement. When we see this, this is the nature of impermanence. The pleasure is not permanent. It turns into displeasure. And displeasure is not permanent. It turns into pleasure. When we see this change in everything in our life, we don't become attached to pleasure or hate displeasure. Look at them, look at both of them with equanimous state of mind. That wise, equanimous attitude is called Nibbida. Disenchantment means wise, equanimous attitude towards ups and downs, pleasure and pain is called disenchantment or Nibbida. I mentioned yesterday, answering a question, I mentioned Nalaka Sutta in Samyutta Nikaya, what do you call, Sutta Nipata, Nalaka Sutta. I don't know whether you remember who Nalaka is. Nalaka is Asita's nephew, his sister's son. Who is Asita? Asita was the one who visited Siddhartha after his birth when he was brought to Kapilavattu. Asita was, he was also called Kala Devala, meditating in Himalayan mountain. And as soon as he came to know that Siddhartha was born, he came to see the child. And he saw this child is going to be a Buddha. And then he was disappointed that he would not live long enough to see him as Buddha. And then he cried. Seeing him going to be a Buddha, he was happy and smiled and so forth. Then immediately he went to his sister. Sister was younger than him. And told, you must send your child to the monastery to be ordained under this Buddha when he attained enlightenment, send him. So she sent her son, and Nalaka became a Buddha's disciple. And when he was Nalaka, in his Nalaka Sutta, in Sutta Nipata, he says when he went on Pindapata, when he received something, he said, today I received, that's good. When he did not receive anything, he would come back to the same root of a tree where he was living and say, I did not receive anything today. That's good too. He was not disappointed for not receiving anything, not overly delighted for receiving something. Because he was the one who has seen the truth. This is not logically provable. But this is the mental state that arises when one understands Dhamma. And that is why it is called not logical. Something physical you can prove logically, psychologically. For example, psychologists can press certain place in the brain and say, looking at the reaction in the laboratory using mice and guinea pigs and rabbits and so forth, they experiment them, or they put what you call biofeedback and various microbiological methods they use to the way how the brain functions. But they can never prove anything with regard to the person's way of feeling. They can prove the way how the mice, guinea pigs, rabbits behave when they do certain things in the laboratory. But they can never tell what happened to them when certain situation arises. They can never predict. They can never tell anybody, this is how I am going to react on such and such a situation. Because the situation can change, the way we react can change, and it is unpredictable. Only when we know the Dhamma, we will know exactly at that moment because of such and such a mental state, this mental state arose. And it also subject to change. And therefore, realizing Dhamma, understanding Dhamma, the way how the Dhamma operates is not logical, but experiential. That is why Buddha said, Pachyattaṃ veditabbho viññohi. Each and every wise individual can realize it by himself or herself. Then, another example. When greed arises, when at that moment one who has greed in one's own mind can know exactly how that person feels. Nobody else can tell that. Nobody else can experience it. Nobody can logically prove it. When greed arises in me, I know exactly how my mind, this mind, behaves. Nobody else knows that. Because I can pretend, I can hide, I can put new, totally different facade, and therefore nobody knows it. Nobody can even experiment my brain in the laboratories to see, to know the way how I feel. They may not know my feeling. they may see the way how I react, squeezing my eyes or wrinkles on my face, twisting, turning, groaning, moaning, making noise and so forth. These reactions they can see. But then nobody knows how I feel. Buddha said in Akalama Sutta, he began with this statement. He asked, when greed arises, is it harmful to you, harmful to others, harmful to both, or is it beneficial to you, beneficial to others, and beneficial to both? Buddha asked them the question. They are the ones who can give the answer. And they cannot say, well, Venerable Sir, when I think logically, it should be such and such. That is not the answer. Because it happens to us in our own personality, and therefore each and every one of us separately, individually, can understand it exactly as it happens. That goes with greed, hatred, delusion and so forth. Then, when greed, hatred and delusion disappears, when greed completely disappears from the mind, as it is disappearing, we feel certain things. As it is disappearing, when it is completely disappeared, we feel another way. So the moment it arises, we feel one way. As it slowly fades away, we feel another way. When it is completely faded away, disappeared, we feel another way. When it arises, we feel one way. When it disappears, we feel another way. Then, we mentioned the word, the upasama sukha, happiness of calming. You can see in the laboratory how the brain operates, brain works when the mind is calm. That is what you can see. That's all you can see. You can monitor it in the computer screen or what do you call this, EKG and so forth, you can see the way how heart operates, heart functions. But you will never ever experience that particular state of peace, of excitement and so forth. That experience you cannot record, but you can record the reaction, and therefore it is not logical. Therefore, this is something to be seen with wisdom. Panyaya pasati. Not logically. Then the other thing is, another example, purification, stages of purification of our mind. When the mind is totally pure, only the one who has that pure state of mind will know the mind is totally pure. That is why when somebody attains full enlightenment says, that is the only person who can say this. Khatang karaniyang usitang brahmacharyang khatang karaniyang naparang ittattaya. I have lived a holy life. I have done what was to be done. At the end, nothing more to be done. Nothing more to be done. Naparang ittattaya. That means only that person knows that there is no more to do. You can never prove it logically, scientifically. No matter how many experiments you run, you can never come to that conclusion because something else can happen. As you all know, that is the nature of science. Nor any scientific conclusion is a final conclusion, because something else can happen sometimes later. But when one attains a full enlightenment, liberated the mind and become totally 100% pure, clean, that individual can say, this is it, naparang ittattaya, no more rebirth for me again. Kinang puranang navang natti sambhavang. In Ratana Sutta says, kinang puranang navang natti sambhavang. All my seed, you have to have seed to start something. My seed all have come to an end. No more new arising there for me. Navang natti sambhavang. No more new seed would there be for to sprout new life. That's it. I have completed the whole course and nothing more left for me. And this kind of things you can never prove logically. And therefore Buddha said, this Dhamma is atakkavachara. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that even in mathematics, they recognize the limits of logic. There was a mathematician named Gödel who in 1932 proved an important theorem in an area called meta-mathematics, because it's not just about the everyday mathematics we use in numbers, but it's about all mathematical systems, every mathematical system. And the theorem he proved is that no mathematical system can be both complete and consistent. And complete means that every valid theorem can be derived and proven in the system. So he said, no mathematical system can be used to prove everything that's true within itself, within its own system, unless it also has inconsistency. Inconsistency would be like a proposition and its opposite, A and not A. Inconsistent. So no system is both complete and consistent. So it's a theorem that proves the limits of deriving true theorems in every mathematical system. There will always be a true theorem which can never be shown. And if you add that to the premises, then there will be another one that cannot be proven. And that is true for every mathematical system unless it has a contradiction built into it.
It's called
the completeness theorem of Gödel. And it's interesting because it applies to every logical system, which is technically called pure propositional calculus of the first order. So it applies to every technical logical system. There will always be something true which cannot be proven inside of it. So it's like using logic to prove the limitations of logic. That's why it's a famous theorem.
Prove logic to show the limitations of logic.
He uses logic to show that there's always something outside of logic which cannot be derived from logic.
From logic. I think that's very interesting. Who is the founder?
His name is Gödel. G-O with umlaut, two dots. D-E-L. It's Gödel's incompleteness theorem.
That's very interesting.
There must be another approach to get all truth.
That is why Buddha was, he said, Buddha is so enlightened that he said that this is not something you can prove by logic, because logic has its own limit. It's amazing. Then the number 8 is nayahetu. Naya is reason. And Buddha said in Sandaka Sutta, also in Majjhima Nikaya, you can see, Sandaka, here a certain teacher is reasoner, an inquirer. He teaches a dhamma, not Buddha dhamma, a dhamma hammered out by reasoning, following a line of inquiry as it occurs to him. But when a teacher is a reasoner, an inquirer, some is well reasoned, some is wrongly reasoned. Some is true, some is otherwise. That is the reason Buddha did not... This is a very interesting part, but I don't have time to go through the whole detail. But I want to bring out the most important part, or last, of course, is reflective acceptance of a view. And that also is interesting. View can be right or wrong. And even in the Buddha's time, there were 62 different views based on the theory of soul. And that's another very big area. And even that I don't want to get involved in now, right now. But I want to come to the last section of my observation of Kalama Sutta. That is the message of Kalama Sutta not emphasized enough. This is the message, which is not emphasized sufficiently. Buddha asked Kalamas whether greed, hatred and delusion are harmful to oneself, harmful to others, and harmful to both, or are they beneficial to oneself, others, and both. They replied that If somebody cultivates them, they are harmful to oneself, harmful to others, and harmful to both. Then Buddha asked, are they blamable or praiseworthy? They replied, they are blamable, not praiseworthy. Then Buddha asked them, is cultivation of generosity, loving friendliness, compassion, appreciative joy and equanimity beneficial to oneself, to others and to both? Their reply was, yes. They are beneficial to oneself, to others and to both. Then Buddha asked, are they blamable or praiseworthy? The answer is, they are praiseworthy. Then Buddha said, having abandoned greed, hatred and delusion, if you practice these four sublime states, you don't have to accept anybody's view, anybody's words. You will experience their results by yourself, within yourself. This is a universal statement, not provincial, not limited to the Buddha Dhamma. It is universal. For instance, to be generous, you don't have to be a Buddhist. You don't have to be a Buddhist to be generous. To practice loving friendliness, metta, you don't have to be a Buddhist. Anybody can practice metta. To become compassionate, you don't have to be a Buddhist. Anybody can become compassionate. To appreciate others' joy, you don't have to be a Buddhist. Anybody can do that. And to practice equanimity, you can be anybody. Practice equanimity. And there are results. While you are practicing generosity, you experience it within yourself. Nobody else knows it. When you share something with somebody, with pure heart, clean heart, without expecting anything in return, nobody knows how, what you experience. Have you experienced that? And I'm pretty sure you might have done a lot of generous things. When you are practicing your generous thing, practicing generosity, only you know, the recipients don't know. Recipients don't know anything that going on in your mind. They just receive it. But in your heart, you experience something nobody else can explain, even you cannot explain, but you really feel within yourself something wonderful, and something you feel that you should have all the time when you practice generosity. Similarly, when you practice metta, loving friendliness, while you are practicing it, you feel within yourself something inexplicable. When you are compassionate, nobody can see your compassion except, of course, very tiny little external expressions. Through those expressions, somebody can say, so-and-so is compassionate. But nobody knows the kind of feeling, inner experience you have. Nobody knows. Similarly, when you appreciate somebody's success, achievements, appearance and so forth without becoming jealous of that person's success and so forth, within yourself you feel something wonderful. You can let that person have what that person has. You feel it. Similarly, when you practice equanimity, you will know how you experience. So, these are the four things that the Buddha wanted to, five things that the Buddha wanted to emphasize in this discourse. Irrespective of what other individual tells, you know, prior to the Buddha went to Kesaputta's village, Kalamas had heard all kind of things, views, ideas, opinions, philosophies, traditions. And sometimes some of them are very controversial. And Buddha did not get into any of these things. He simply addressed the very fundamental issue that affects all living beings. That is why we say him fully enlightened being. He did not attack anybody. He did not criticize anybody's view. He simply pointed out universal truth. And that part has not been very well emphasized, stressed, when in Kalamasutta. Whenever we talk about Kalamasutta, we go through the all other superficial things. But the core heart of Kalamasutta is this, practicing for Brahma Vihara. Then Buddha said, Kalamas, when you yourself know these things are good, these things are not blameable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them. When we practice these things, we know. You experience inner peace, tranquility, calmness, your own soft heart, generous heart, compassionate heart, you experience it. If you experience it, you go ahead and do it. You don't ask anybody's opinions. Don't ask, can I practice generosity? Is it beneficial? Can I practice compassion? Buddha said, you don't have to ask anybody. You don't even have to discuss with anybody. You do it yourself. So sometimes people think that this discourse and other discourses of the Buddha provide us empirical evidences of truth to support the Buddha's teaching. So, in fact, we don't have to rely on any empirical evidence to support the Buddha's teaching. The evidence are within ourselves. So, finally, Buddha gave four kinds of solaces. And that also is a very wonderful statement. I don't think in any other tradition you find these four. Let me read the four. Suppose there is a hereafter and there is a fruit, results of deeds done well or ill, then it is possible that at the dissolution of the body after death, I shall arise in the heavenly world, which is possessed of the state of bliss, if there is hereafter, if there is life after death. That is the first solace. Second is, Suppose there is no hereafter, and there is no fruit, no results of deeds done well or ill, yet in this very world, here and now, free from hatred, free from malice, safe and sound and happy, I keep myself. Third solace. Suppose evil befalls the evil doer, I, however, think of doing evil to none. Then how can ill affect me who do not do evil deeds? Solace number four. Suppose evil does not befall the evil doer, then I see myself purified in both ways. That's solace number four. I think with this I like to conclude. There are many more things to talk about. My last remark is faith in Kalama Sutta. By asking Kalamas not to accept these 10 points and dismissing all of them, the Buddha did not throw away baby with bath water. In Chanki Sutta, for instance, Buddha showed how faith arises. He has advised bhikkhus and bhikkhunis to behave in such a way that those who are not pleased in the triple gem will arouse their faith in the triple gem. And those who already have faith in the triple gem will increase their faith. So Buddha did not completely discard faith. Even our behavior should be in such a way that those who do not have faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha will have faith. Seeing, hearing, associating with us, with bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. And Buddha said, if there are people who have faith, your behavior will increase their faith in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. As we have mentioned, there are 10 persons worthy of offerings. Out of them, 2 are called faith devotees and realized by faith, and Dhamma devotees and realized by wisdom. Faith is emphasized in many places in the Buddha's teaching. Among different states of faith, the faith in the Buddha is the highest faith. Addressing Bhagava and pointing out to him how hard for him, coming from another tradition, having another faith, following another doctrine, to attain and abide in the beautiful, that is, Santa Vimokkha, beautiful liberation of the Buddha, you must strive hard, putting your trust in me, the Buddha. So Buddha asked Bhagava to trust him, to have faith in him. And he said, Saddha Bijang, faith is the seed. Saddha Tarati Oghang, one crossed the ocean or flood with faith and so forth. He has mentioned the importance of faith in many places. That faith is based on understanding. Knowing the truth of the Dhamma, one gain faith, and that is the faith called Achala Saddha, unshakable faith. And that is the beginning of real practice of Dhamma. With this, I like to conclude the presentation of Kalama Sutta, and I encourage you to read it again and again, and you will see many different interpretations and translations of Kalama Sutta.